If you have got your Bibles this morning or at home, I want to invite you to turn to the book of John. It's already been, we've already know that we're right into the Christmas season here. And I know that some of you have been here already since Halloween. And I don't know what your rule is about decorating. I feel that this is a cause that I can get behind. I don't know if you have had it up since like Remembrance Day or not. But I think it's the 11th commandment, thou shall not decorate before December 1st. Is anyone with me here? A few. A few of you are casting stones right now. I'm sorry. As we've already hinted at earlier in the service, our theme for the next 4 weeks is going to be on a light, actually the light, who has come into our darkness. So, if you look at the book of John chapter 1, you won't immediately go, wow, that really rings of Christmassy type themes for me. The difference between John 1 and other Christmas texts like Matthew chapter 2, Luke chapter 2, is that John tells the story of the coming of Jesus in the form of almost like a philosophical or theological poem. And his poem has nothing to do with shepherds and the angels and a manger. It is trying to understand what is going on behind the scenes when the second person of the Trinity, Jesus, the Son, becomes human. And John is struck with wonder, with astonishment at the identity and the significance of the person in the manger. And we're going to read the whole poem this morning, but then focus in on just a few parts that relate to our theme. And what I'm trying to do this morning is maybe set the stage, so to speak, for this theme of a light in the darkness. I think in the following weeks and as we get towards Christmas Eve, that we're going to take a lot more of a story-based approach. But my hope today is that we can understand who this light is, what it means that he's come into our darkness, and that way it lays a bit of a foundation for some of the stories that we'll recount in the following weeks. So, John chapter 1, starting right at the beginning. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John, and he came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through him all might believe. He himself was not the light, he only came as a witness to the light. The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet, to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of a human decision, or of a husband's will, but born of God. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. John testified concerning him. He cried out, saying, "This is the one who I spoke about when I said, 'He who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me.' Out of his fullness we have all received grace in place of grace already given. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made him known." All right, that's pretty heavy. In fact, that may be as heavy as it gets in the New Testament. And as you can tell, John mixes a few metaphors in his poem. And first he starts out with something called the Word, and then he switches midstream into something about the light. What or who is he talking about? The Word was with God in the beginning, and through Him all things were made. The Word became flesh and made His dwelling among us. The Word, or Logos, was actually a very hip, intellectual word at the time John wrote this. And I'm going to explain it the way I understand it most, in a simple way, from a good preacher in Vancouver named Daryl Johnson. And Daryl says that for Greek intellectual people, when John wrote this, Logos referred to that something that brings order to the universe, or that which makes life go round. For Greek people, the Word, or the Logos, was the unifying force behind all existence. Now, if you were a Jewish intellectual, Logos referred to something a little bit different. For Jews, the Word was the speech by which people can know and understand the invisible God. Or the Word or the speech in Genesis chapter 1, which brought the universe into existence. So, John is reaching out to both groups by saying that the Word became flesh. He's saying to Greeks and Jews that the Word isn't a force or a philosophical idea or just words that God spoke at the beginning of time. The Word is, in fact, a divine person. A person who had now come to live in the very place that He had made. The baby in the manger is actually none other than God Himself, the all-powerful, all-knowing, everywhere present, creative, breathing life into human beings, God. That being, that person, had now become human. Now, if you know something about the Christmas story, you know that the Holy Spirit caused Mary to become pregnant, even though she was a virgin. And on the night He was born in Bethlehem, God took on skin and bones. Jesus the baby, Jesus the teenager, Jesus the man, embodied everything that is essential about being a human being. And He also, at the same time, embodied everything that is essential to being God. He was fully God and fully human at the very same time. And the fancy theological word for that is incarnation. God in flesh. God becoming human. And to people back in Jesus' day, and to a lot of people, frankly, in our day, it seemed as though Jesus was just an ordinary guy, because He was indeed fully human. But surprise, surprise, John says, He is actually at the same time God. We have seen His glory, John says, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. No one has ever seen God, but God, the one and only who is at the Father's side, has made Him known. All right, this is a little heavy, but stick with me for a little bit. When you think about it, if Jesus really was God in the flesh, then living in His family must have been kind of weird, right? Imagine all the ladies in Nazareth having coffee on Tuesday morning with Mary, complaining about their kids and what they do, and she is saying, you know, actually, my boy is a perfect child. He never does anything wrong. And the other ladies around the table are rolling their eyes, right, right. Whatever oddities Jesus and His families might have experienced, and we actually know very little about what it was like when He was a kid, what we do know is that they got one huge privilege. They got to see what God was like up close. That is, in fact, a major reason that Jesus became human, so that we humans can see and understand what God is like. That was mind-blowing for our poet John, because before his time, before Jesus' time, people didn't get to see God up close like that. If you look at the Old Testament, the Israelite people would never dream of getting up close and personal with the living God. To them, God was huge and powerful, and if you ever got close, you would probably die. If you read the story about Moses getting the Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai, the Israelites got to experience the glory of God up close, and it wasn't really that exciting for them. Let's hear the story. This is Exodus 20. When the people saw the thunder and lightning and heard the trumpet and saw the mountain in smoke, they trembled with fear. They stayed at a distance and said to Moses, "Speak to us yourself and we will listen, but do not have God speak to us or we will die." Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. God has come to test you so that the fear of God will be with you to keep you from sinning." But the people remained at a distance while Moses approached the thick darkness where God was. They saw God's glory descending on Mount Sinai with smoke and clouds and thunder and lightning, and it was scary. They saw God's glory talking to Moses in a tent set up outside the camp, but they themselves would stand at the entrance to their tents watching from far away. They saw God's glory descend on the tabernacle when it was first built, but no one, not even Moses, dared go inside. But when Jesus came at Christmas, that way of relating to God changed for good. From then on, anyone gets the opportunity to get up close and personal with God. No need for a special tent, a special place, another special intermediary like Moses. No need for fear. No one has ever seen God but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made him known. Moses only got to see God's back. But Mary and Joseph and the shepherds and the Magi and Peter and John and the disciples, they got God in person. They got the glory of the one and only. And the best part is that that privilege isn't reserved just for people who were there for the first Christmas or for 33 years in the first century. It is for us too. Through Jesus, we get to see what God is like. Jesus has now pitched his tent in our backyard, and he wants to be known by you. When you watch him in action, you are indeed watching God in action. When you see Jesus holding little children in his arms and laughing with them, that is God demonstrating his love for kids. When you see Jesus have compassion on a crowd like sheep without a shepherd, that is God's heart for lost people. When you see Jesus getting ticked off with money changers at the temple, that's God displaying his attitude towards people who use religion as a way to make money. We saw God's mercy in action when we saw Jesus showing compassion to the woman caught in adultery. We understand God's attitude against proud people when he expressed his anger towards the Pharisees. We see God's patience as Jesus endures the flogging at the hands of his Roman captors. When you see Jesus carrying the cross through the streets of Jerusalem, you see God bearing the weight of your sin on his shoulders. And when you see Jesus hanging on a cross, that is God demonstrating his love for people who don't deserve it. And I know we love nature here in BC. We love creation. And it is true that when you look up at a clear night sky here, you are catching a glimpse of God's glory. When we here in BC experience the power of a storm, that is indeed somehow a taste of the awesome power of our Creator. The Rockies, the immensity of the Pacific, going down to small, the intricacy and complexity of molecules and atoms and electrons, all of that points to the majesty and creativity of the Holy One. But John would say, if you really want to see the glory of God, you can do no better than Jesus. Which is why it's a little disconcerting when John switches to the metaphor of a light coming into the darkness. Here is God become human, his really biggest miracle ever, designed to enable mortals like us to understand and relate to the invisible God, and we don't get it. Back to our poem. The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Let me try to illustrate what I think John is trying to describe here. In my bathroom at home, I have a set of lights which I would say are the brightest lights that I've got. Why do you suppose that I would put super bright lights above the mirror in our bathroom? So that, right, I can see exactly what I look like, right? Which is getting more and more depressing every day, and probably why I don't like turning on the lights as much in the bathroom than as I used to. The light exposes my flaws, right? Where I miss the spot shaving. Pimples, wrinkles, increasingly more gray hair, or worse, empty spaces where hair once grew. Now, imagine if I could use a light like this one. This is apparently 2,000 lumens, bright enough to light up a trail as you're biking down at night. If I were to use this one to look into the mirror at night, what might it expose about me? Now imagine, and Tyler, you can kick back on the lights, imagine that I had a light big enough that it would be maybe 100 billion lumens. A light big enough to be called the light of men, the light of all humanity, maybe even the light of the world, the light that bright. What might that reveal about me? Do you see what John is getting at here? When people are exposed to Jesus, the light of the world, the one who is God and reveals God to us, the light is so intense that we are exposed. His light penetrates even to dividing soul and spirit, deep enough that it can judge the thoughts and attitudes of my heart. When we come into a close encounter with Jesus, everything about us is laid bare. Certainly, all that he has made, we're made in his image after all. And much good is revealed in the light, but also that which is unhealthy and selfish and, well, quite frankly, dark. And when that happens to us, our natural reaction is not to run into more light, but instead to turn around and head back into darkness. And it is a tragedy. He came to the place he made, to people made in his own image, and they did not recognize or receive him. A little later on in his book, John says, this is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but people loved darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does what is evil hates the light and will not come into the light, for fear that their deeds will be exposed. And yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. We're going from tragedy to comedy here, right? Ephesians chapter 1, even before he had made the world, God loved us and chose us in Christ to be holy and without fault in his eyes. God decided in advance to adopt us into his own family by bringing us to himself through Jesus Christ. My friends, this is the unexpected, incredible, awe-inspiring, humbling opportunity open to every human being on the planet. Despite your darkness, despite your instinct to run, to turn from the light, God will not be deterred. Through Jesus, the Word made human, the light of the world, through him, we can be God's kids. If we say yes, if we receive him, Jesus gets us adopted at no cost to us, but at great cost to him. That's not what we expected. Philip Yancey writes this: from nursery school onward, we are taught how to succeed in the world of ungrace. The early bird gets the worm. No pain, no gain. There is no such thing as a free lunch. Demand your rights. Get what you pay for. I know these rules well because I live by them. I work for what I earn. I like to win. I insist on my rights. I want people to get what they deserve. Nothing more, nothing less. Yet, if I care to listen, I hear a loud whisper from the gospel that I did not get what I deserved. I deserve punishment and got forgiveness. I deserved wrath and got love. I deserved debtor's prison and got instead a clean credit history. I deserve stern lectures and crawl on your knees repentance. I got a banquet. Too good to be true, do you think? Would God really bring a person with lots of darkness right into his family? Well, let's test my theory on one of the original set of Christmas characters. Let's consider the wise men, or as they are sometimes known, the Magi. Matthew says this: after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who is born King of the Jews? We saw his star, and it rose, and have come to worship him." Now, who are these guys? Because I grew up singing about We Three Kings and a rubber cigar, and I have no idea really who the three kings are. To better understand who the Magi are and what their profession was, you need to just add a C to Magi. What do you get? Magic, right? How do you suppose that the Magi came to follow the star to Bethlehem? It's because they were into astrology. Astrology, not astronomy, which is the scientific study of the stars, but astrology, which tries to determine how the movements of the stars influences our daily life. This is the stuff that we use today to guide horoscopes and star charts and figure out your destiny according to the movements of the galaxies. The Magi used magic and astrology to divine the future and advise the political leaders of their day. That's how they got rich, and that's how they became influential. And if you check out the rest of the Bible, especially Isaiah chapter 47, if you got extra time to read today, observe how magicians are observed in the Bible, and it's always negatively. To put it bluntly, for Hebrew people, if you were a Magi, you were straight out an idol worshiper. And so imagine if you are an early Christian and you are They wouldn't really be picking up a copy of the book of Matthew. But let's say they were hearing Matthew read, and they heard that some of the very first worshipers of Jesus were New Agey practitioners of dark and secret arts. You would have been blown away. Really? These guys were invited by God to come and worship the newborn king? Seriously? Like, how did that happen? They were using the movements of the stars to divine the future, and then God decided, well, you know, I'm actually going to do something. I'm going to cause something to happen in the cosmos, make a star appear, I don't know, a comet, we're not sure, some kind of unique celestial event in the Milky Way. Whatever, God made it happen in such a way that the astrologers picked it up. They decided to pack up their stuff, made the trek all the way to Israel and to see what was going on in Bethlehem. And if you were a Jewish Christian and you thought a little bit about how that all went down, you are going to say to yourself, no way. Maybe it would be cool if they happened to pick up like a scroll of the Torah or the prophets or something and they were reading about this. That might be a legit way to get them to Bethlehem. But through watching star movements, not that way. Not these people. To which Matthew might respond, yes way. These guys. And yes, God did it that way. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed and worshipped him, and they opened their treasures and presented the king with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Outsiders welcome. No matter how dark, no matter their background, no one need be excluded from entering into the courts of the king. To all who believe him, to all who receive him, to all who come into the light, they are welcome. In fact, throughout his ministry, the light of the world made it clear that his message was one of God's love for so-called outsiders and sinners. For prostitutes and social rejects, for the weak and the sick, those born on the wrong side of the tracks, that's who he had come for. A few years ago, I happened to be watching some late-night TV as Christmas was approaching, back in the day when Jay Leno was still on TV. That year, a band that was 100% off limits to me when I was growing up had recorded a Christmas album. And for those of you who grew up in the 80s, maybe you heard Twisted Sister when you were growing up. I was not allowed at my house or maybe even within a square kilometer of my house. But that year, they released a Christmas album. And on Jay Leno, they were performing the signature song of that album, and maybe I'll test you millennials. What is Twisted Sister's most famous song? Someone acknowledge it here. Someone give a prize to that man. Although in church, I don't know if you get a prize for knowing that. We're Not Going to Take It. And if you know We're Not Going to Take It, you may know that Dee Snider, who is the lead singer, the handsome gentleman in the center there, that song and the chord progression is basically ripped straight off of O Come All Ye Faithful. If you follow the music, it sounds virtually identical. So I watched the band that night, full heavy metal regalia, dancing, singing one of the most famous Christmas carols of ours in church, which is essentially an invitation to worship Jesus, right? And at first, I was a little put off. And I thought, you know, this is sacrilegious. That is to say, it failed to show proper respect to someone who is sacred to me. But the more I watched and the more I thought about it, the more I came around. If the Magi were invited to the original Christmas night, if the one born in the stable would grown up to be known as a friend of sinners, then Twisted Sister is certainly welcome to Bethlehem as well. And so are you, no matter where you are this morning. No matter how dark your past, he makes you this promise. To all who come into the light, to those who believe in the Word made flesh, you get the right to become children of his Father. Won't you come? We're going to sing together and return right afterwards to the communion table. Those of you who are at home, we invite you to prepare. Why don't you stand as we sing together?